You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Whether you encounter his writing at the theater, in the movies, or on the page, Paul Rudnick is likely to make you laugh. His plays include I Hate Hamlet, Jeffrey, The Most Fabulous Story Ever Told, In and Out, and Adam's Family Values are two of his movies. I Shudder and Other Reactions to Life, Death, and New Jersey is his latest book. It's a collection of essays, and it's published by HarperCollins. I'm very pleased that it has brought Paul Rudnick back to our show today. Hi.
Hello. Good to be back.
Now, New Jersey, because you're from New Jersey, Piscataway?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I particularly enjoyed that recent corruption sweep through New Jersey. It had one of my favorite headlines. I think it was online somewhere where it said, "Everyone in New Jersey has been arrested."
Well, in the popular culture, there are a limited number of career choices for people from the state. Rock star,
that's
mobster,
true.
Corrupt politician, or you can sleep with the governor. How does humorous fit into the mix?
Well, that's the only thing left after the one of my favorite New Jersey factoids is that the last three governors have all broken their legs while in office. And Governor McGreevy, who is just a humorist's gift, he broke his leg while he was shooting a New Jersey promotional commercial. He was strolling along the beach with his then wife outside Atlantic City, extolling the glories of the New Jersey seaside, when he fell into a pothole and broke his leg. And it's the gift that keeps giving.
He also gave you a wonderful line when he explained the lack of interest in his ex-wife's memoir.
Oh, yes. That was when he and Dina published dueling memoirs, and he attacked her savagely, and he said her book would not sell well due to her unfortunate appearance on Oprah wearing a dress with a plunging neckline. And I love that this level of cattiness was coming from a man who is now studying to become an Episcopal priest.
Well, she was unhappy with him, and she did say nasty things about him.
Yes, she did. And she was, when I watched her on television being interviewed, I had a choice between sort of compassion and just being overwhelmingly appalled, because she kind of went into that marriage knowing what was going on, but she was in a level of denial that was pretty great, even for New Jersey.
You mean she suspected that he was gay?
Well, I believe his first wife had warned her.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, you thought, Dina, you know, there, don't you have any friends?
As I said, you're from Piscataway. How did the Chamber of Commerce choose to distinguish your hometown in its advertising?
Oh, well, there was a wonderful, deeply memorable billboard along the highway that featured a cartoon version of two Native American braves with the full war paint and feathers. And one of them was shading his eyes with his palm and scanning the horizon. And the caption in huge letters read, "They went Piscataway." Even as a child, I remember I was always knew that Native American tribes, and rightfully so, often asked for their ancestral lands back, but they never seem to want New Jersey.
aren't you being a bit unfair? Look, New Jersey is the Garden State,
yes.
And it's not all that far from New York City, the cultural capital of this country, and many people feel of the world. Can a place that close not be influenced?
Oh yeah, and New Jersey. It's funny. It's so easy and deeply necessary to condemn New Jersey, even though a lot of it is absolutely gorgeous and there are wonderful people there. But anytime you start to sort of staunchly defend New Jersey, it just sounds so terribly sad.
And you say that New Jersey never disappoints.
Exactly. I think it's one of the things I genuinely admire about New Jersey is that it keeps you humble. No one in New Jersey could ever afford to put on any airs.
Okay, now we have outraged all of our New Jersey listeners. Let's talk about your family. What did your family think about the things you write about them?
They are generally pleased. I wrote a novel called I'll Take It that was very much a tribute to my mother and her sisters and their Olympic scale shopping abilities. But the characters in the novel also tended to shoplift. So my mom and her aunts and my aunts used to tell everyone, "It's all true except for the crime." Although I remember the thing that did upset me was that they tended to send the book to all the other outlying relatives in Florida who would pass it around. There was always that sense of, come on, guys, everybody buy a copy.
You say your family always always obsessed with your diet. You refused to eat healthy food?
Absolutely. And it was not out of any deep vegetarian or moral conviction. I was just born.
You mean you weren't an animal rights activist or anything like that?
Not in the least. But the only animals that I happily devour tend to be marshmallow peeps and chocolate bunnies.
And we have marshmallow peeps on the cover of the book.
Indeed.
Now, why that?
Well, because it's one of those foods that tend to genuinely appall and upset people. If you eat them happily, and also the sort of crystalline sugar dust on them comes off on your clothes and your skin, people can't quite believe you're actually enjoying yourself.
So you were just trying to upset people with your eating habits?
Not deliberately, but it was a welcome side benefit.
And your family sent you to a child psychologist.
They did when I was about 7. And even then, I remember he gave me a lot of educational playthings to fool around with, you know, wooden trains and Swedish dolls. And I knew that he was imagining somehow that I would be distracted by these items and spill my guts. And I just wasn't having it. So what I basically told him the truth about everything, and he told my parents that I was shockingly well-adjusted and they should just leave me alone and wait and see what happens, to which my mother replied, like a time bomb.
Well, that was before you fell in love with Pringles, right?
Well,
aren't Pringles fake potato chips kind of made out of scraps like Chicken McNuggets?
How dare you? Pringles are probably the foremost advance of our age because Pringles are a food that is designed to stack. Because I love the notion of whatever conceptual meeting that was where they said, you know what's wrong with potato chips? They're not neat enough. Mm-hmm. They're not aerodynamically perfected yet. So I've always felt that Pringles, and I say this with the deepest admiration, were probably made for, they're sort of a food form of fiberboard, that they're compressed maybe newsprint and packing materials, but they are absolutely delicious and you are assured that everyone will be identical to the chip before.
Your brother took a different path, didn't he? But neither have taken the kind of path that your middle-class Jewish family had planned for you. How have they reacted?
It took a while, but they're actually, I think my parents did something that many parents of their generation did. They raised their kids to be hugely independent and free-thinking, and then they were horribly upset when the lesson actually took hold, because my brother and I have both very much gone our own ways.
At one point, he accused your mother of being a bad mother because she gave you Fruit Loops and Ringdings.
Yes, that's where he had a moment of therapy with my parents, where he had that therapy discovery episode that anyone who begins on that journey has, where they realize, oh my God, there's a deeper inner meaning to every action. But he got over that. Although there was a moment, my brother, who is a absolutely terrific guy, but he also upset my parents. He's always had very long hair and a ponytail and a long sort of ZZ Top scale beard. And he, while being a total sweetheart, looks fairly dangerous. And when the earliest wanted posters for the Unabomber came out, where there were just the descriptions of his general mane, and my mother and I called each other up, and we were a little worried, but we were both thinking the same thing, which was, could my brother be the Unabomber? And we went through the other known facts and decided probably not.
Actually, the Unabomber's brother turned him in, so
yes.
It was somebody else's brother. But you haven't had weight problems, as far as I can tell. You've always been slim ever since I've known you, and that's quite a few years. Did your diet improve as you got older?
Absolutely not.
So as you've grown older and richer, have you just moved on to gourmet sweets?
No, not in the slightest. And that's a common error that people who realize the level of my sweet tooth, they sometimes think, I'll buy Paul Godiva chocolates or something imported in Belgium. And I hate that. I think of that as candy for people who don't like candy. I'm a fan of Nestle's and Nabisco and anything that has enough refined sugar to ruin an entire Indian village.
My guest is Paul Rudnick, the playwright, film writer, essayist. His latest work is a collection of essays called I Shudder and Other Reactions to Life, Death, and New Jersey. It's published by Harper. How did you come to live in John Barrymore's former apartment?
Oh, well, that was about, maybe 18 years ago now, I was apartment hunting in New York, and I saw an ad in the New York Times that said medieval duplex.
Medieval?
Medieval, and that seemed very intriguing, unless the
working fireplace or anything like that.
No. Although it had a non-working fireplace, but it just, I've always been attracted to the Gothic and the baronial, so this, I made a beeline, and I climbed up five flights of stairs in this wonderful brownstone, and there was the apartment that Barrymore had lived in and done over when he was performing his legendary Hamlet on Broadway further uptown. And it looked like the set for a Sherlock Holmes murder mystery in Summerstock.
One of the most unbelievable details of that story is that you went home to think about the apartment after you'd seen it, and it was still available the next day.
I know. Although we're back in that sort of real estate moment, because that was a real lull, and I realized that we've come full circle.
Well, did that lead you to thinking about writing I Hate Hamlet?
Oh, absolutely, because I thought, wait. Also, I had a wonderful agent at the time who's no longer with us, who was this very eccentric German woman. And when I told her that I was thinking of taking the Barrymore apartment, she said, perhaps you will find my hairpins. Because it turned out that she had had an affair with Barrymore's son-in-law many decades earlier. So the karma of the situation just became overwhelming.
Well, the karma seems to have been overwhelming in other ways. I mean, then you have the play, and
yep.
I'm sure many people remember the story about Nicole Williamson and the problems you had with him. He did have a reputation for acting out badly, drinking, hadn't he?
Stupendously so. He was a real world-class alcoholic genius/loon.
Weren't you warned at all?
Absolutely. We were told by our terrific casting director that we should only cast Nicole Williamson over his dead body. And sadly, we did not listen, and we learned the hard way. Because Nicole gave, at times, a magnificent performance, and then something would snap, something would take over. And one night, there was a climactic duel that ended the first act with very long, very dangerous swords. And he took out after his co-star, who was absolutely blameless, and stabbed him for real and drew blood. And the co-star very wisely left the stage and the production at that point. And his understudy continued that evening and the rest of the run.
I would have thought that this would have alerted you to beware of that anything can get out of hand. I mean, like what happened when you wrote or came up with the original idea for the film that eventually became Sister Act.
Oh, yes. That actually, I was lying on my couch in the Barrymore apartment when I had that idea. And I always thought that the idea of a showgirl stashed in a convent after she's witnessed a gangland hit seemed, if nothing else, like the punchline to a great dirty joke. So I plunged ahead, and the film was originally written for Bette Midler, who seemed like a just natural fit for that showgirl. And over the course of the next couple of years, it went through probably hundreds of drafts and ultimately landed me in a convent. Because I found myself in meetings with Disney executives who we were discussing the differences between Franciscan and Benedictine orders, and I'd look around and realize we were all Jews.
Well, that didn't turn out as happily as some of the others, but Adam's family values turned out rather nicely for you, but you went through equally weird things in getting that film done.
Oh, that was pure joy, because the people involved, from the producer Scott Rudin and Barry Sonnenfeld, who directed it, were just the best sort of co-conspirators, and it had a superb cast.
Well, Christina Ritchie, who was just 10 years old, actually helped you come up with an ending.
Oh, yeah, because I did an overhaul on the first movie. Then the second film is all mine. But on the first film, we were sort of puzzled as to whether the there was an Uncle Fester figure who might have been an imposter or might have been the real Fester returning after many years lost in the Bermuda Triangle, because it was that kind of movie. And since we couldn't figure out what to do, we asked the cast, actually, and they appointed Christina as their spokesperson, who was actually, I think, 9 at the time, and she was by far the most sane person on the production, and she told us what to do, and we did it.
We can't get to all the other things that you write about here. There's a lot of different things. We write about In and Out and other things, but you do write about AIDS, and it's hard for a humorist to write about AIDS, isn't it?
Very much so, although it was the challenge I had when I wrote a play called Jeffrey, and people were initially quite taken aback by the notion of a comedy about AIDS. And the disease itself isn't funny in the slightest, but I find that people's behavior and is almost always, especially in the most dire circumstances, often very funny. And I also wanted to salute the wit that was at in the early years the only weapon anyone had against AIDS, particularly in Manhattan.
There are people who will argue that gay people are just wittier and more sophisticated as a rule than heterosexual people.
If only. Dream on, gay people.
Paul Rudnick's latest book is I Shudder and Other Reactions to Life, Death, and New Jersey. It is published by Harper. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Oh, my pleasure.